working correctly, and I can usually check it through this. Looks like it's all right. Yeah. All right. Let's just begin then by indicating that today is March 1st, 1991. This is Jim Boning, Beckman Center, talking with Fred Bisolo in his office at Northwestern University. I know you were born on the 11th of February, 1920. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Well, my parents are ethnic Americans. They, like everyone else at the turn of the century, immigrated to the U.S. with very little formal schooling. I think they probably went through the third grade or so. My father was a coal miner in southern Illinois, and that's where I was born, in this little coal mining town, which is a sort of a disaster at the moment. The mine has no longer been working, so it's a one of those kinds of areas. But at any rate, I grew up in this little community, which were all foreign laborers, and you could go all day without speaking English, and I practically learned how to speak this peasant dialect of Italian before I learned how to speak English. I learned how to speak English when I went to school, you know. And other than that, I spoke what they call Piemontese. So my parents both, of course, became citizens, and that was a big occasion for them. And my brother and sister, neither one of those, they were older. My brother 11 years older, he's no longer alive. My sister 9 years older. They came along during Depression, when they really had to go to work and help out, and didn't even go to high school in those days. In those little mining towns, a lot of people didn't go to high school. And by the time I came along, of course, everyone went to high school, but not everyone went to college. And I was fortunate in being able to go to college, to Southern Illinois Normal University, which is, at that time, was just a teaching school. And so I got a Bachelor of Education degree.
The Depression, you were 9 years old when the Depression came.
That's right.
Did that have much of an effect on your family?
Well, it did. I mean, you know, all of these people, these immigrants that had come over, it was a tough life, you know, just working in... Excuse me a minute. Yeah, all these immigrants in that little mining community managed to buy a little plot of land, and they had their own one cow and one pig, which they butcher every year, and they had their chickens, and they supplemented their income with such things, and garden. They always did gardening and so forth. So it wasn't easy, no. It was difficult, but these people came from conditions which were much worse than that, so to them it was still quite satisfactory. Sure.
What was your schooling like?
Well, elementary school was just a very small school in this little mining town. It was more than just the one-room schoolhouse, though. There were it was kind of a building which had, I guess, about four different rooms in it, so that the first and second grade were together and so forth. Third and fourth and the like, so you could go there and get the and do your all of your elementary school. That's no longer true at the moment, but you had to go to the neighboring town of 2,500 to go to Christopher Community High School. And in those days, there were practically no paved roads, you know, and there were certainly no school buses, mm-hmm. and so we had to drudge through the mud and snow and whatever else, about a couple of miles or so to get
there. What was the name of the town?
Christopher.
Oh, okay.
Christopher Community High School.
Did you have any teachers at that time that had any influence on you that you remember?
Yes. One in particular at the high school. Well, probably more than one, two or three, but the principal of high school took an interest in students. I mean, the high school was small enough, so he knew who the students were. And he was very much involved in and encouraging me to go on to college, because no one from this little mining town had even gone to college before. Not only had my brother and sister not even gone to high school, but no one even in my age had even gone to college before. And so it was, it was an effort on his part to at least convince me that this was the thing that I should do. And fortunately, I was able to do this because Roosevelt and his PWA programs had a youth program, and I was able to go on the basis of the fact that the tuition in such a school, state school, normal school, was extremely small, practically nothing. And this youth program that Roosevelt had set up paid $25 a month. That $25 a month, plus I had to do work-study type things and so forth, so I did several things. Plus staying in the attic apartment of the Dean of Women's House and taking care of, in those days, you didn't have gas heat, you had coal, stoking her furnace, and in the summer mowing her lawn and so forth. I even had money left over, you know. We did light housekeeping up in the attic apartment, and at the end of the month we'd have a little money left over, and we'd go out and have a few beers, so it was possible, and I managed to do it.
Did you have any science exposure in high school?
Yes, and that's interesting, because we were always, and I'm one likewise, who always pointing to the fact that you really need good science teachers who motivate and who themselves are excited about the science in order to motivate youngsters into the sciences, into engineering. But my chemistry teacher was an attractive blonde gal this was her first job, who had majored in home economics. And home economics at that time required at least 1 year of chemistry, which the home economics majors took begrudgingly, and she did likewise. But when she got to this high school, there was nobody there to teach chemistry, and she at least had a year of general chemistry, I guess. And so she was given the job, her first job, among other things, I guess, to teach this chemistry course. But she was such a charming young lady, and so as honest as the day is long, and she just simply admitted that she didn't know all that much chemistry, even though she'd had a course. And she did one thing that I think, at least in my case, had a very positive effect. She said, look, here's the laboratory manual. We'll do our lab on Saturdays. Those of you who are interested in doing the lab part of the course, I will be here to supervise, but you will have to read the lab notebook and come prepared to do the experiments. And I'll just be here to supervise, make sure you don't blow yourself up. And that's what she did. And it really gave us a chance to be slightly creative, at least to the extent that we had to read the directions and follow them on our own without having being spoon-fed by somebody. And I think that that, at least in my case, was kind of a stimulus in that direction.
What kind of experiments did you do?
Well, it's a long time ago. I can't remember all that much, but I think that we were doing just the usual things of generating oxygen, potassium chlorate, and manganese dioxide, and collecting hydrogen, and such things as that. But they had enough chemicals and enough glassware that you could do a few things. And the class was small enough. So.
Mm-hmm. What about physics and mathematics?
I had algebra in mathematics, and I had no physics in high school, if I remember correctly. My first physics class was when I went to college.
And what was Southern Illinois like when you arrived there? That would have been, what, 1936?
36. It was, as I say, just a normal school. So people who went there, like myself, went there because that was really in their neighborhood in Southern Illinois, and that was probably the only place they could afford to go. But they also went there knowing that when they finished, they would teach. They would teach in elementary school, or they would teach in high school. if you went 2 years at that time, you would teach and you would get a certificate. You wouldn't get a bachelor's degree. You get a certificate which would qualify you to teach in elementary school. If you went 4 years, you would get a bachelor's degree. Only one kind of a bachelor's degree was offered then, and that was a bachelor of education. So you had to take all the education courses, practice teaching, and so forth. And then at the end of that, many of my colleagues at that time went into teaching. Not all, of course, but it was believed that that's where you would end up. Well, that's not where I ended up, obviously, but that's where I might have ended up.
Well, had you looked at being, had you thought then you'd be a science teacher as you were progressing through this? Is that
well, I think, sure, by that time, that's exactly right. I arrived there, and, you know, this was a big time for me, even though it wasn't really all that big time. And fortunately, they had the four, what we ended up calling four horsemen, or even their pictures are up there in my office there on the wall. And these four guys, one was an analytical inorganic chemist, one was a biochemist, one organic, and one a physical chemist. They were dedicated teachers, you know, and Professor Nickers, particularly, who was chairman of the department, took a real personal interest in all of us. And after a couple of years, well, first of all, I just automatically got put into chemistry when I was enrolled and advised what courses to take the very first year as a freshman. And I did well. And anybody who did well, immediately the people in chemistry, kept an eye on them. And along about my junior year or so, Nickers called me and talked to me about going to graduate school. And my first reaction was, what the hell is graduate school? My parents are expecting me to get a job as a high school teacher and make a living. What's this with graduate school? And so it came really not as a planned kind of thing. It just happened.
Can you tell me something about the courses you had, the chemistry courses?
Oh, yeah. We had very good coverage of chemistry at Southern at that time. And these fellas, the classes were small enough that they were in there with us in the lab, and the lectures were small enough that you could even ask questions and so forth. And a little bit of... Let me try and catch somebody.
Sure.
Okay, where were we? I can't remember.
Well, we were talking about the chemistry that you had.
Oh, yeah. It was very good coverage because I think Nickers did the general chemistry, inorganic general chemistry. That was in those days. It was, had a lot of inorganic reactions and so forth. And the analytical he did as well. And then Professor Abbott did the organic chemistry, and I'll always remember organic chemistry. In fact, not only will I remember, but I still have J.B. Conant's book.
Oh, yes.
Right
yes.
Here. Every once in a while I reach for it. And right now I'm reaching for it and I don't see it, but it's here. It's here. And that was the book we used. And although I ended up being an inorganic chemist, I remember those lectures and I remember using that book. And physical chemistry was done by a fellow by the name of Van Linney, who was also very dedicated and a very good physical chemist. And he was a hard-nosed individual and really drove you. And then we even had biochemistry, so that it was a very, very good...
Do you remember the text in physical?
I think it was Hildebrand.
Okay.
I think so, yes. Uh-huh. And then, of course, I had practice teaching in chemistry, and that was a disaster because the old codger that was the high school teacher for whom we had to do practice teaching by that time knew less chemistry than we did, and we could see that we knew more chemistry than he did anyway. He certainly had a lot more experience of handling classes than we did, but that was a different kind of a ball game.
Did that help you make a decision about not going into high school teaching? How did you react to that experience?
Well, I think that when Nickers gave me this pep talk about going on to graduate school, by that time I developed a lot of respect for four of them, and they all had PhDs in chemistry. And it just seemed to me that, gee, if he really thinks highly enough of me and I'm sufficiently interested, which I was by then, why stop and go into high school teaching? Why not take him up on this and apply for teaching assistantship in various places? So I did, and finally ended up in Illinois.
Did you do any kind of independent work, laboratory work?
During
Southern?
At Southern, no. The closest thing, I guess, was when we took the biochemistry course, but even that was not independent. I mean, because Scotty was always around, and we were collecting our own urine, you know, and doing tests on it and so forth. But no, they didn't have independent undergraduate research in those days. Not there anymore. Mm-hmm.
What about some of your other laboratory experience? Did you do any inorganic laboratory work?
No, I think that the inorganic laboratory work as an undergraduate was what we did in general chemistry. There was no separate inorganic course taught. There was a separate wet type analytical course taught where we had a semester, at least if I remember correctly, of titrations and gravimetric and those kinds of things. But that's it.
Well, general chemistry was certainly a lot different than it is today.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Except when I teach general chemistry, I still try to teach reactions.
I want to come back to that later on. You've written some things about that, so
that's
I'd
right.
like to come to that later on. Did you have any class? How many chemistry majors were there with you?
Yes, that was a particularly good year. They've always had some very good, they've always, in those days, were quite successful in having several chemistry majors who went on to do graduate work and got PhDs. And Dick Arnold, for example, I don't know whether you know who he is, but anyway, he's a very outstanding organic chemist who's few years older than I am, been retired now for some time, but he was one of the people that we were always being told about. And in my class there were half a dozen of us, and we all went to graduate school, and we all ended up getting PhDs. And just this past November, the class of 40 had its half century homecoming. So some of us showed up there, you know, and we hadn't seen one another for ages, and it was kind of interesting. Not all six of us showed up, but three or four of us did. And these other people, I guess I'm really the only one that went into academic work that people know about as well, but the other people were very successful in industry and so forth, so they did very well.
Did others go to Illinois with you, or were you the only one?
Oh no, there were three of us who went to Illinois, as a matter of fact. Yeah, mm-hmm. There was the guy who did organic chemistry, a guy who did physical chemistry, and I worked with John Baylor in organic chemistry. But I was the only one that took an academic position. These other people were extremely successful in industry. I mean, they became whatever you become, research directors and titles of one type or another, and ended up very successful.
Did you apply anywhere else besides Illinois?
Yes, I think I did. I think I applied only in the Midwestern schools, and I think I got offers from all of these, but Illinois, since I really hadn't been away from Southern Illinois, it was already a big, big jump for me to go to Champaign-Urbana. I can remember when I first arrived there and saw all these this huge campus with all these huge buildings, the noise building and everything. I was really impressed.
I was going to ask you then what it was like your first year there
at Illinois,
and how your background was from Southern in terms of how you could compete with the other entering graduate students.
Well, I think the three of us, since there were three of us, had no real difficulty competing. We took all the courses. There were courses really almost the entire first year. And at the end of the first year, you had to take what was called a qualifying exam in each of the four areas. And none of us had any trouble getting through those. So I guess I don't recall having any particular course difficulty. And the one problem that I did have, but was solved in an unbelievable way, is you also were required to pass one of two language exams before you started your second year of graduate work. That was one of the rules. And so I had had 2 years of German, but I didn't know all that much German. And I'd never had any French, and usually you took German and French as the two languages. And so I put it off until summer, thinking that during the summer I'd bone up on the German and take the exam and hopefully pass it so I could start the second year of graduate work. I don't know what would have happened if I had. But what happened is I took that German exam, and it was terrible because it had to do with making hydrogen peroxide electrolytically, and my translation was so poor that I knew it was poor because the chemistry that I was writing down didn't make any sense. And so I was almost certain that I had failed. And there was a week between then and when the French exam was to be held. And I decided, well, gee, I'll sign up for the French exam and see if I can get ready for it. And French is not the same as Italian by any means, but some of the words are, you think French isn't all that bad. It's not as bad as German, anyway. And it's amazing. I boned up with Dolt's Chemical French or whatever it was, and learned as much as I could in 1 week, took the French exam, and I felt better about the French exam in terms of the chemistry as it turned out in the translation. Thinking that, gee, if I pass, I'll probably pass the French exam. Well, a few weeks later, the results were out, and I passed both of them. So got rid of both of them. So I was really, that was the most frightening thing that happened. But the most comforting thing that happened was when I arrived at Champaign-Urbana, as I say, from a place like Southern Illinois, never having been out of Southern Illinois, this was big-time stuff. And these were big-time professors, you know, they were real giants in organic chemistry. I mean, people like Roger Adams, yes, and Speed Marvel, and, you know, you name them, they were there. Well, there was also Reynolds C. Fusson there, who was no slouch.
Yes.
And Reynolds C. Fusson taught the beginning, the course, the graduate course for beginning graduate students in organic chemistry. And one of his hobbies was to learn as much as he could about each of the graduate students in his course. And even before you arrived, he would have gone through your file and saw who you were, where you were from, this, that, and the other. So when you walk into his office to register for his course, he could start a conversation with you. And in my case, because of my name, Basolo, and so forth, and because of his interest in Italy, he'd been there several times. There were even stories about maybe he had a mistress there or something. Whether that was true or not, I never did find out. but he immediately greeted me, you know, in Italian, and I spoke to him, and he said, "Oh, you should be able to speak Italian better than that." And I said, "You're absolutely right. This is peasant dialect." But anyway, even though I only had his course, he and I, and he had me, he was a bachelor, and he had me over to his apartment to have a good bottle of Italian wine and listen to some operas with him and so forth. So he and I became very good friends and continued to be good friends until he actually passed away. Mm. And it was very comforting to have somebody, one of the big shot professors, make you feel welcome. And of course, when I decided to work with Baylor, he was very outgoing and very pleasant, so I had no problem.
What about some of the other instructors that you had that first year?
Well, I had Phipps and Rodebush in physical chemistry, and I think they turned me off more than they turned me on. Neither one of them were really that good as teachers. And in any case, I think that I had, by that time, pretty much made up my mind that I wanted to work with John Baylor and do inorganic chemistry, so that didn't do much.
Did you have Baylor in that first year?
I did, yes. I think I did. I think it's either that first year or the second year. I took the course from him in coordination chemistry, which was his specialty. And,
what was it, getting into that area, what was it that attracted you to Baylor and the inorganic chemistry?
I think it was probably, I really can't put my finger on it other than the fact that looking back, it might be that Jim Nickers at Southern was somebody that I warmed up to and had a lot of respect for, and he was an inorganic analytical chemist. And so I thought that, gee, maybe I'd like to do the kind of chemistry that Nickers did. And that might be what kind of set it up to begin with. And then when I got to Illinois and started looking into it, and in inorganic, I was really second-class citizenship, as I was saying, even at Illinois. I mean, the giants were all organic chemists. And although they had 300 or so graduate students, only half a dozen of them, or six or eight or ten, were inorganic graduate students. And they only had three or four inorganic faculty. Baylor was one, Lou Audrieth was one, Moeller was another, and so forth. So that when I talked to the inorganic faculty, Baylor was clearly the person that I knew I would enjoy being associated with. So that turned me on.
When did you start your research then?
I think it must have started the latter part of, well, or in the middle part of the second year, because the first year was really devoted almost entirely to coursework, getting ready and passing those qualifying exams.
And you had a teaching assistantship at the same
time? And I had a teaching assistantship, but at the same time, I guess, and I got some kind of a university fellowship and so forth. Well, maybe I must have started research a little earlier, because I really did manage to finish in 3 years. I did get my degree in 43.
Mm-hmm. And, well, the war started right after you, during that first year that you
right.
were there, the war started.
That's exactly right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons that the faculty there were doing what they could to have people try to finish or get enough done so that they could finish, and in my case that worked out. That's exactly the way it worked out. I was able, I guess, to get enough done to have an acceptable thesis and take a job. And I had two job opportunities. One was at the University of Chicago on the Manhattan Project, where they couldn't tell me what they were doing and so forth, and the other was at Roman Haas, which was on classified research, which they couldn't tell me what it was all about, but they could certainly tell me about their work on resins and everything else that they were doing as a chemical industry. And I don't know, I just felt more comfortable because I knew a little bit about something that was going on at Roman Haas, and I didn't know a thing about what was going on in Chicago. And I guess by that time I was beginning to feel like, gee, you ought to get out of the state of Illinois for a little while, and so I went to Philadelphia.
Before we moved to Philadelphia, what were the laboratory facilities like at Illinois when you were doing research in your PhD work?
Well, they were, by today's standards, they were pretty primitive, you know. OSHA could never have approved anything that was going on there. There was no such thing as the kind of ventilation that you're supposed to have and so forth. And the kind of sophistication that was going, was available to you to do this kind of chemistry was minimal. I mean, infrared wasn't being used all that much even, you know. Certainly there was no NMR or anything else. And X-ray diffractometers were not in existence and so forth. So that it was just at least in the research that I was doing and that most people were doing in terms of synthesis and reactions, it was just glassware of the ordinary classical type that was being used. In my case, it was aqueous chemistry, so it was just solution chemistry, and compounds were not air sensitive or anything else, so you could just use ordinary flasks and beakers and so forth.
Did you measure, because you did a lot of it very early on when you came here, did you measure any absorption spectra in Illinois, or was that still too early?
No, that was just at the beginning of measuring absorption spectra, and I did do some, just a few spectra of some platinum complexes, that's right, but it was sort of a primitive kind of thing.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how you, the reason is that this year is the 50th anniversary of the DU.
Oh, yes.
Which would have been 41. So, that's right, started coming out in late 41.
Mm-hmm.
So did you have a DU? Is that what you were using?
Yes, I can't even remember the instrument that we used. And I used it in conjunction with somebody else who was actually doing spectroscopic kind of things.
I see.
And so I was not all that knowledgeable about what kind of instrument it was. And I don't remember it being a DU, though. My first instrument that I used when I got here was a Beckman DU.
Well, that's why I was curious,
yeah,
asking that. What if you weren't using a DU, what you were using?
I can't recall what predated a DU, but there must have been something at Illinois that some of the physical chemists were doing and getting UV visible spectra.
Well, there was a GE put out an instrument that was developed by Hardy. I'm not sure. Would your measurements been in the ultraviolet? Would you have gone down that far?
I would have certainly gone near ultraviolet.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, because these platinum compounds are virtually colorless, so
All right.
Would have had to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Now there wasn't much available. It was simplified before the DU. That was.
That's it. I don't think this was, and I think it was the sort of thing where, you know, you know your fellow graduate students, and you say, look, I'd like to have a spectrum of this thing, and you go down and bring your solution with you and hang around. And my thesis, I'm sure, has a couple, two or three spectra in it, but it probably doesn't tell you anything about the instrument.
I've noticed in many papers at that time that frequently the authors will say, we thank so-and-so for the measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it stops, so you get no idea, because I've been interested in that part of the history of it.
I see.
Pre-DU spectroscopy.
Yeah, that's interesting now that you mention it.
And it's very frustrating to look at a paper and say, we thank so-and-so for the measurements. There's no indication of
how they were made. Maybe that's what's in my thesis, as far as I know.
How theoretical was your... Theoretical inorganic chemistry, certainly in its infancy, but how theoretical was your training at Illinois?
Well, mine was not. Mine was not at all, because going in the direction that I did, and I also ended up, you had to take courses outside, at least one or two courses. And I taught, being an inorganic chemist, I took ceramics, actually. And some of the people in Illinois, of course, as physical chemists, would take math or things like this, but I didn't. And so as far as the theory was concerned,
we just simply use seat-of-the-pants kind of valence bond theory to explain structures, magnetic properties, and so forth as best we could of these Wernicke complexes. Mm-hmm. And in those days, that was what you had. I mean, in retrospect, that wasn't all that we had. But the coordination chemists didn't learn about crystal field theory until later, although the physicists knew about crystal field theory at the same time that Pauling's valence bond theory appeared, and even before. But since chemists were not reading physics journals, they didn't. They were not aware of crystal field theory until in the 50s, actually, the early 50s.
The problem you worked on, did Baylor assign that, or did you select it from a list of things?
Well, Baylor suggested that here were two or three things that he was interested in, and allowed me to select the one that I thought I'd be most interested in. In fact, I think there were two. We ended up doing what we could with one of the problems, and it didn't seem to be going anywhere, and then we backed off and worked on the other one, and that one did at least result in a couple of publications.
Yes, you had a paper in 1950 which was based on your thesis, but there was a woman on that paper.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, Betty Rabtar, that's right. She predated me, and we overlapped just a little bit, but not all that much. I just overlapped enough. She was, I think, in her last year as a graduate student when I was just getting started. But the work that she had done had to be carried a little further before it would be publishable, and that's what I did. So,
what did she? Two questions, I guess. What did she go on to do? And were there many other women at Illinois at that time?
No, there weren't many women, and I don't know that I've ever heard any more about Betty Rabtar after she left. I really don't know that whether she went into industry or just what she did.
What kind of person was Baylor to work for?
I think he was superb. I mean, he's the type of person I think that I would want to work for. I mean, he was interested in the work, so he would always be available. He in those days was not traveling all that much, so he was there much of the time. And when he was there, he would always drop by the lab and inquire as to what was going on. But he wouldn't necessarily be dropping by the lab to check up on how much you've accomplished and what you're going to do next and so forth. He would just come by to interact socially and professionally and give you an opportunity to ask questions and to tell him what you've done and what you're planning to do. So it was an ideal arrangement.
Was there much war-related work going on at that time?
Yes, there was. Particularly as summer jobs. In those days, you know, we had TAs, and that was an academic year thing. I think the salary was $65 a month. But during the summer, you could take a summer job. And during the war, some of that was government-sponsored research. I mean, Speed Marvel had all this synthetic rubber kind of thing going on. But Audriot and the inorganic chemists had fluorophosphonates and nerve gases and all kinds of nasty things going on and so forth.
Did you work on some of that?
I did not. I was able to continue with my research, and I think I'd gotten a university fellowship or something, so that whatever it was, I did not do any of that. You know.
Was your reaction when you got to the big city of Philadelphia in 1943?
Well, that also was a big time for me anyway. And I worked at this research lab of theirs in one of the suburbs called Bridesburg, which is right along the river. And it's a pretty ethnic Polish place, you know, with all the taverns and everything else. It's sort of was and still is, I guess, a pretty much of a slum manufacturing area. But anyway, I wasn't buried, and there were other people like myself just really waiting for the war to be over. And I, you know, that was a war that we supported. And it wasn't easy for a person my age to be a civilian, because my father was dying of cancer, and on two different occasions I was called home, and you'd go down to North Philly and get on the train, take the train to Chicago, and those trains were wall-to-wall people, and people my age were all in uniform, and you'd have to be in the train sitting next to somebody whose husband had already been killed, or whose son had been murdered, or at least they were out in Guadalcanal or some such place. So it was an uncomfortable thing, and some of my colleagues actually went in and volunteered and got officer's rating, and I was tempted once or twice, but I finally decided, gee, they must know what they want me to do. So I would get these greetings always, you know, to go in for a physical, pass the physical, wait to be called as a GI, and then at the last moment they'd defer me again. And then we'd go through this again and again, and eventually, of course, the war was over. So I never did go to war.
Did the company, was the company behind those deferments, do you think?
Well, I think the fact that the company was doing this war research, this classified thing, and the work that I was on, I guess, might have been important. And we succeeded in doing what we were asked to do. We were supposed to make synthetic mica, and we actually succeeded in making a material which could be used as synthetic mica. It never turned out to be commercialized, because it's the natural mica, the source of natural mica never was was always available, I guess, in the U.S., so they didn't have to rely on this, but they could have if they had to rely on it. So there were those kinds of things, and I guess, sure, the deferment would come because of whatever the priority rating of such research was.
Who was your boss at Roman Haas?
Oh, there's a guy by the name of Lorne Hurd, who had gotten his degree at Wisconsin. Can't remember who he worked with at Wisconsin, but he was the boss. Yeah, Lorne Hurd. Don't know what ever happened to him.
And were there many people in the group you were in?
There were two other PhDs from MIT in our lab, and then the other people were non-degree people, I guess, the bachelors or what have you. They were assistants of one type or another. So the lab probably had 8 or 10 people in it, but only 3 of us, plus Hurd, of course, 4 of us.
How did that MICA project take the whole 3 years that you were there?
No. They were in the zirconia pacifiers, zirconium dioxide, and so they had a lot of zirconium minerals and so forth, and they were trying to make zirconium derivatives of one type or another in waterproofing fabric and things like this. So that I did at some stage get asked to work on the synthesis of some zirconium compounds that might be of interest, and so I spent some time doing that as well.
Had you thought, as the war was coming to an end, had you thought about what you wanted to do when the war was over? Were you to stay in industry? Or?
Yeah, I think I probably knew even when I went there that I would want to, when it was all over, have an academic job of some sort, because I guess I came up through normal university with thinking even in terms of high school teaching and so forth. And I had taken such a liking to Nickers and to John Baylor that I sort of thought that it would be nice to be in a position akin to what they were doing. And so all of the 3 years that I was there, actually, it was really a good time for me to think in terms of an academic position and what I might do when this was all over. And although my work with John Baylor was on synthesis, reactions, and stereochemistry of these kinds of compounds, I did have a chance to go to the library and read about some of what the physical organic chemists were doing in terms of their physical organic chemistry, solvolysis, kinetics and mechanisms, SN1 and SN2. And it just seemed logical to me that the same kinds of things could be done with some of the compounds that I was familiar with. And so I really had a pretty good idea what I wanted to do the day I arrived here. And perhaps that was the reason that things took off rather quickly. And we were able to tackle this problem. And fortunately, as I say, it was fortunate for both of us. Ralph Pearson was here, and after a year or two, I was able to seduce him into doing this rather than doing physical organic.
What kind of things were you reading? Reading Hammett's book?
That kind of thing, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Why did you, as an inorganic chemist, why did you pick that kind of thing to read?
Well, I can't recall exactly, except that it was a book that seemed to be something about organic chemistry that wasn't just the Diels-Alder reaction. You know, coming to Illinois in those days, I remember the end of the first year when we had to take this qualifying exam in each of the four areas. The organic chemistry one was being taught in those days, not in terms of mechanisms so much, but was being taught in terms of name reactions. And I had made index cards of name reactions with the name on one side and the reaction on the opposite side. And I must add, bunch of them that thick. And in preparing for this this qualifying exam at the end of the first year, I kept going through these cards, and as soon as the stack that I got correct got bigger than the stack that I got wrong, I decided I was ready for the exam. So I think when I looked at Hammett's book, and I looked probably at some review papers, and it looked like there were people doing things other than that kind of organic chemistry, it struck my fancy. And particularly the solvolysis type reactions were pretty straightforward and kinds of things that I could appreciate. And it just kind of triggered that kind of interest.
You left Roman Haas in 1946. What were the circumstances around that? Were you in a position to leave after the war was over? Did you go out searching for a position, or were they terminating employment at the end of the war?
No, I don't think they were terminating employment. I think we could have stayed, and some people did stay. But a few of us did leave, those of us who really wanted academic positions. In my case, as another in my colleagues' cases who were there also who left, at this point, you know, the GIs were coming back, and they were all going to the universities. And the universities found that the enrollments were such that they had to get out and get more faculty. So there were an abundance of faculty positions available, and I think I applied a few places. And again, the one that I really looked at seriously was this one, because by that time I felt it would be nice to get back to the state of Illinois again. And I didn't know all that much about Northwestern, but when I came here, there was really no inorganic chemistry other than P.W. Selwood. He was an inorganic chemist, had been trained by B.S. Hopkins of Illinois on rare earth chemistry, but actually Selwood was doing heterogeneous catalysis and that kind of chemistry. And the fellow that was the inorganic chemist here had just accepted a job, I think, at the University of Colorado Boulder. And so the junior-senior level course that he had been teaching in inorganic chemistry was something that they needed a faculty person for, and it sounded exciting to me to have an opportunity to step in and teach that course. In those days, there was not even a textbook of inorganic chemistry. Moeller had not yet written.
That's right. I used Moeller.
That's right.
Remember
so
that
book. So I made up my own notes, you know, Emilius and Anderson, the several books that were around, and did the best I could, and I enjoyed teaching that course. And I think that course was also very helpful in getting graduate students here to go into inorganic chemistry, because...
Was it required of them?
It was a course that was taught at the undergraduate level. And it was taught in the fall quarter. And we had students coming, as we always do, from all sorts of places, coming from schools where they did not, in those days, have such a course. They just didn't have an inorganic course at the junior, senior level, all the whatever inorganic was just in the general chemistry. So those students were really required to take this course, or they did take this course. And in this course, as a result of their taking it when they first arrived, I was able to brainwash a few of them and get them interested in organic chemistry. Let me try and get somebody to get you for here before it's too late.
Well, we were talking about your move to Northwestern. What was the situation of the department? How large was it, and what kind of facilities did they have?
Well, the department was certainly smaller than it is now, but not all that much smaller in terms of numbers of faculty. In terms of the university enrollment on this campus, it wasn't all that much different than it is now. But in terms of graduate students, number of graduate students, it certainly was smaller. And in terms of inorganic graduate students, it was zero, of course. And the situation that I found at that time, of course, was that at least in my particular case, I did have the access to a Beckman DU spectrophotometer. By then, we were doing absorption spectra and following spectral changes in order to follow these reactions. And we had a conductivity bridge that we could also follow these reactions. And we had a polarimeter that we could use when the organic chemists weren't using. If we had some optically active compounds that we wanted to monitor. And we had practically no funds because there was nothing other than research corporations. So after a year or two, I think I got a research corporation grant and the like. So most of our people were on TAs, and we don't have that many TAs, so that you couldn't support large numbers of graduate students.
Who were the, how shall I put this, who were the stars of the department at the time?
Sure. Charles Hurd, of course, was a senior person, I guess, and very well known in organic chemistry and pyrolysis and so forth. The very active group was also Herman Pines and the Padieff and their catalysis lab. And that, not only because they were doing good work, but also because of the fact that the catalysis was important in industry, but in universities, no place other than Northwestern was really doing heterogeneous catalysis in the same sense that it was being done here. Most of that kind of work in those days was being done in industry. Practically no work of that type in universities. So Northwestern has had this long sort of thing with heterogeneous catalysis.
a lot of universities now, of course, are doing it. But in any case, and in physical chemistry, the guy that that really was well known and became even better known is Malcolm Dole, of course.
Oh, yes.
Who was here.
Yes.
And he was a fabulous person, you know. Did a variety of things in terms of his research in the glass electrode. He even wrote a book on the subject. He did electrochemistry, wrote a book on the subject. He did oxygen isotopes and got our standard change, you know, from oxygen to carbon 12. And then finally, even within polymer chemistry and radiation of polymers and branching radiation things and calorimetry of some of these things. So those were the people here that were most productive in terms of research.
See, Pat F. died when? Late in the early 50s, I think. Did you have any contact with him? Or?
Practically none. I mean, his English never really was all that good, and his research interest was different from mine. And so I would see him, and I knew that this was the Russian professor, you know, and so forth. Really didn't have much contact.
Who was chairman of the department?
A fellow by the name of Somerville when I arrived. And just before that was a guy by the name of Ward Evans. Ward Evans was a physical chemist, and in fact, he was the mentor of Ralph Pearson. Pearson did his thesis work here with Ward Evans. And then Ward Evans left here and went to Loyola here in Chicago. And I think it was because he'd reached the magic age of retirement here, so he went there. And Somerville took it on. But Ward Evans, his claim to fame was not his physical chemistry so much. His claim to fame was he was on the Oppenheimer Tribunal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he wrote the minority report that they should not strip him of all of his classified things. He should still have access to all this and so forth and so on. So that was his big achievement, I guess.
And then was Whitmore his predecessor?
And Whitmore was, I guess, prior to that, and that's really before I got
yes.
here. Yeah.
Did you teach anything else besides this junior, senior level course when you first came?
General chemistry.
General chemistry.
Yeah. And in those days, we were not only teaching general chemistry, and I didn't start right out giving lectures in it, but Somerville, who was an organic chemist and chairman of the department, he liked to teach general chemistry, so he took on most of the bulk of the teaching, and the rest of us were sort of his assistants, and we would take the quiz classes, so we would
take
the quiz classes. We weren't using graduate students in those days here because, well, one reason was Somerville thought that the graduate students were not capable of doing this and doing it as well as he would like, and he kept pointing out that here we are, private institution charging these large tuitions and competing with state schools, and at least we ought to give the students a little more for their money than they get when they go to state school, so we ought to have regular faculty doing the quiz classes. And during his tenure as chairman, that's exactly what was done. Yeah.
How long did it take before you got your first graduate student?
I got my first graduate student who is Bill Castor, and I think it was 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 years. Let's see what it says here. I got here in 46, and usually they write a little something about themselves. College.
kids attended Northwestern. Okay. It says here he arrived in 46 and left in 50. So I probably got him a year after I was here. He was my very first graduate student. And he probably started doing his research in 47. Yeah.
Did he have your course? Is that how you were getting yourself introduced?
Well, yeah, sure. That's exactly right. That's yeah. And he did some zirconium chemistry because at that time I had just come from Roman Haas and I'd been doing this zirconium work, and there were a couple of things that I thought might be interest to him, and I was doing myself the kinetics and mechanism of some of the, you know, I was in the lab with my own hands, my first two or three papers at least.
Yes.
Single author.
Yes, because you had your first one 1948.
Okay.
Which was even before your PhD thesis was published.
I think that's right, yeah. Because it took a little while to get all this stuff that I'd done with Betty Rapp and Baylor.
And then the other one was in 50. So at that point, were you still looking, in addition to the zirconium work, you were still looking at synthetic work, but your interests were more in mechanisms.
That was right at the beginning of when I was getting into doing solution kinetics and mechanisms and getting Ralph to come on board.
I was going
to
ask you how you...
Ralph to come on board and so forth.
How you seduced him.
Well, simply this way. In those days, the department had hired about a half a dozen of us coming in as beginning instructors. About three or four of us survived. The rest didn't survive and went elsewhere. But when we arrived, some of us started having lunch together. And I guess it was Carol King. He was an organic chemist in his office. And the office of this size or even smaller, when you get three or four people in there, it's pretty full. But we would bring our lunch and we'd sit and we'd talk about whatever topic happened to come up. It didn't necessarily have to be chemistry. It could be football or basketball or it could be anything, baseball, the Cubs or what have you. But chemistry, of course, was always or oftentimes a topic of conversation as well. And on those occasions, day in and day out, we would, if we came in with something that was puzzling us or something we were thinking about in terms of our research about to do or something, we might bring that up and talk about it. So little by little, after trying to convince Ralph and his listening to me and telling him what was happening, he finally came around to deciding that yes, this is there are things here that can be done, and this is what we should do, and this is how we should do it in terms of the kinetics and the mechanism. And I could always come up with the complexes that should be used. We should use this for the following reason. We should use that. And I, in those days, could still go in the lab and actually make these compounds. You know, in fact, even when Harry Gray was here, who's probably our most graduate. Harry was busy working with me and Ralph, and he was doing solution kinetics and mechanisms of platinum compounds that I had actually made, I knew how to make. And I told Harry how to do it, you know, and gave him the recipes and so forth. And, you know, the second time you try to do something, you don't get the yields that the person who had done it several times. And so Harry would get discouraged, and finally I said, okay, well, just let me make them, and you can just run the kinetics. Come in! Charles!
This is the guy I want to see.
Well, there he is.
Good morning. Here's what...
So it was a slow process before Ralph really got totally into it, and he always maintained a certain interest separate from this, but this began to take
up the bulk of his time. And in fact, not only that, but he finally, the outside community, chemistry community, he became recognized as a physical inorganic chemist. And his award, ACS award, is in inorganic chemistry. It's not in physical chemistry and so forth. So that, he really did make a complete change.
As I said, my recognition of him as a student was, of course, for Austin Pearson.
The kinetics and mechanisms.
Never at that point would have thought about his association with inorganics. When you started doing this work, this was pretty new in terms of the rest of the world, was there any Ingold, you there's some, I want to talk about that if you would like, but I know there's some disagreement there with Ingold's work.
Well, that's
did that occur early on?
Yes, and fortunately it turned out to be quite a turning point as far as Ralph and I were both concerned, because Ralph and I were just beginning investigators, you know, in this area of physical inorganic. But Ingold also in physical inorganic was just beginning. That's why things happened the way they did. I mean, he was really one of the very best people as far as physical organic chemistry was concerned. But Ron Nyholm, who later became knighted, Sir Ronald Nyholm, Sir Christopher Ingold, and so forth, joined the department there at University College London and started talking to Ingold about his metal complexes, and showed Ingold some of our papers, some of our initial papers, particularly the base hydrolysis reaction is where this all happened. And the reaction that takes place with cobalt amines is first order in the cobalt complex and first order in hydroxide ion. However, hydroxide ion seems to be specific, the specific base that carries out. Other nucleophiles that you might use, the compound doesn't respond this way. So Ralph and I came up with an acid-base pre-equilibrium type mechanism and conjugate base then undergoing reaction and so forth, which all fit with the second order kinetics. It was consistent with that, and it made more sense to us, and that's what we published. Well, when Ingold when this was pointed out to Ingold, I guess, by Nyholm, the people at University College London, he looked at it, he thought, gee, those two guys, they don't know what they're doing, and this is just an ordinary second order displacement type reaction, just as we have with alkyl halides and hydroxide. And so it came out very loud and clear and strong on this. And it took some doing, you know. You can, as I've always told students, it's impossible to prove a mechanism is right. That's because mechanism is just like any other theory. It's a theory, and it just is not possible to prove it's right. But it is possible to prove that a mechanism is wrong. So then it was up to us to do what needed to be done to try to prove that the mechanism that Ingold had proposed is not correct, which we were able to do, fortunately, because if it had turned out the other way around, you probably never would have heard of Basola and Pearson, and our Northwestern would never have become famous in inorganic chemistry. But it was kind of amusing, because all of this was happening in the late 40s and early 50s, when I had gone on a couple of ACS lecture tours, and I remember going out to the Pacific Northwest and on lecture tours, and yet people would come to my lectures, and I would be all excited about what we were doing. And at the end of it all, somebody would ask her, "What is a chelate, you know? What is a ligand?" and it really, really was a little depressing. But then, about 6 months or so, 6 or 8 months later, I went on a similar lecture tour. I guess this time I was out east someplace. And the attendance was better, and I could see that there were organic chemists there, you know, in addition to inorganic
I'd come along anyway. But the organic chemists were there because they had read Engel's paper. And they wanted to find out what the hell was going on and what Pearson and I were up to and why Engel was even bothering to take time of day to pay attention to us. And so they would come, and it was an entirely different audience because they were physical organic chemists who were able to ask the questions that needed to be asked, you know, and so forth. And as it turned out, of course, we were able eventually to show that the mechanism that Engel proposed was not correct. And so that went a long way in terms of helping both Ralph and myself.
How did Ingold react to that, you know?
Like an English gentleman that he is, I mean, I remember back in 61, 62, and this was still, it was almost over by then, but it was still going on. I was a guest of his department there, Ron Nyholm and Jack Lewis and all these guys that I knew, and gave a talk. And afterwards, I met with him in his office. And we had just done what we thought was a very definitive experiment in dimethyl sulfoxide, not in water. And we're able to show that this pre-acid-base equilibrium rapid reaction is responsible for the first order dependence on hydroxide. But when I told the discussed this, or it was in one or two of my slides in my talk, well, Engel, the first thing he wanted to point out to me was that but Fred, dimethyl sulfoxide is not water, you know, so it doesn't tell us anything about what happens in water. Well, fortunately, Henry Taube was doing this kind of chemistry, and Henry Taube at that time was at Chicago still, and Henry and I would keep in touch. And I knew that Henry Taube had done analogous experiments in water using oxygen 18 labeling. And the results were consistent with what results we had gotten in dimethyl sulfoxide. So I was able to tell Engel about this. And he polished it off. But Engel was notorious for doing this kind of thing. I found out later among physical organic chemists that there had been times in physical organic chemistry where he had not been right, but he would never admit in print that he was wrong, and he never did admit in print that he was wrong here. He just simply looked the other way and went on to something else. But Nyholm and Taube and these people were certainly, and Taube has published several papers where he uses the conjugate base mechanism, just the one that we had proposed.
How did, as you began this work, how did the rest of the inorganic chemists respond to what you were doing? The Solo and Pearson book didn't come out until when?
In
58. There we are. How did the rest of the inorganic chemists
respond? Well, first of all, there weren't that many inorganic chemists in those days. There were some. There were beginning to be more and more because a lot of people had gone on the Manhattan Project and had become interested in the transition metals and the actinides and lanthanide-type metals and so forth. So there were more and more inorganic chemists. But not all that many. And so our papers were being read, finally. I mean, in the early days when I worked at Baylor and not long after, you publish a paper, you never hear any reprint requests or anything else. But there was a cadre of physical inorganic chemists out there, such as Taube and others, who had worked on the Manhattan Project, who really were interested in the solution chemistry, kinetics, and equilibrium mechanisms, and so forth, that were reading our papers. And And there were even, I think, the first symposium on the subject of mechanisms of inorganic reactions was held at the University of Chicago, set up by Henry Tabby. And I presented a paper there. Later on, we had a symposium here just about, I think it was right at 58, just about the time our book came out. We had a symposium. By that time, we must have had about 60 or 70 people who attended that symposium here on mechanisms. So it all of a sudden took hold. And the book, of course, was a winner from the day it arrived, because it was the first such book. And particularly, it was the first such book that not only had mechanisms in it, but likewise had crystal field theory, and made use of crystal field theory in trying to rationalize some of the results. So the timing was just absolutely perfect. And,
how did you pick up crystal field theory?
Well, I'd never even heard of it until I went to Copenhagen in 54-55, a year's leave of absence. And I went there with Professor Yannick Bjerm. Yannick Bjerm is well-known by coordination chemist, did his thesis on measurement of stepwise stability constants of the copper-ammonium complexes, and then all of that took off. His father was Niels Bjerm, who was even a more famous, almost got the Nobel Prize. There are stories about why he did it or something. Anyway, when I got there in Yannick Bjerm's lab, he had people, Carl Ballhausen, who's outstanding in theory and crystal field theory, Kingsville Jorgensen, likewise, and so forth, Klaus Schaefer, Wolbe. He had four or five people, just young assistants in his lab at that time. And what these people were doing was crystal field theory, which I hadn't even heard of. And what they had that I didn't have was they had Mark I of a Cary spectrophotometer, which was not gray, it was black, actually. The first ones they made were black. Later they made them battleship gray. And the reason they had that is, of course, in Copenhagen at that time, Carlsberg family had finally gone down to this one person who hadn't married, didn't have any financial responsibilities, and was interested in the arts and sciences. So he set up the foundation here many years ago, Carlsberg Foundation for the Support of Arts and Sciences in Denmark. So as you go around the museums and any place in Denmark, you'll see usually courtesy of Carlsberg Brewery, or Carlsberg Foundation. And they had bought themselves the very first Cary spectrophotometer. And there was Kingsville Jorgensen down there. He was really a terror in the lab. But anyway, he was taking spectra of all of the aqua transition metals, just all of them practically, and every spectra that he took of these things, it was another paper interpreted in terms of crystal field theory, because the valence bond theory, which I grew up on, could not even begin to interpret those spectra. But crystal field theory did it very well, did it very nicely, those people who were capable of doing it that way. And these people certainly handled English quite well, but their written English needed some polishing. So almost every Monday, almost every week, Kingsville particularly, and Ballhausen, but mostly Kingsville, would come in with another manuscript, which he would give to me to help him put it in better English. And so I got my exposure to crystal field theory this way. And I immediately let Ralph know, because he's more physical, more mathematical, and so forth than I. And he looked into it. And by the time I came back after that year's leave, he had looked into it sufficiently that he was all excited about it. So the book that was written in part by me while I was on leave of absence. And when I got back, I again had to convince Ralph that he should join me as a co-author, and we should do this. And he was, you know, less than enthusiastic until he read a few of the chapters that I'd written, and then he got excited, and then he saw how he could really fill in the crystal field aspects of all of this and really bring it all together. So he jumped in with both feet and finished up the book. So together we wrote the book. The first book was easy to write because at that time the kind of work that was going on of this type, kinetics and mechanism, either we were doing it or Taube or a few other labs, and we knew exactly what everybody was doing and what the status of it was and so forth. So you didn't have to conduct much of a literature survey. You pretty much knew everything that needed to be known. So we could sit down and write the book as we did without all that much effort. Later, of course, in 67, when we revised it, it was much more of an effort because by that time the whole thing, the whole field had grown by leaps and bounds, and then you had to be selective of what examples you would use to illustrate whatever principle you wanted to illustrate. And subsequent to that, even now, people are still banging on our door wanting us to revise it one more time because it's gone out of print. And in most countries, in many countries, they still hustle up enough copies to use it. They prefer to use it to some of the more recent books that have been written on the subject. And I can understand it because there's it covers it covers the area in sufficient detail. And a more comprehensive coverage. The ones that are written now are written by somebody whose interest is specifically bioinorganic chemistry or specifically homogeneous catalysis or specifically something else. So this is still being used, although it's out of print everything.
Did you have a commitment from the publisher before you started?
No, it was not written with any intent of making money or that it would make money. And it sold like hotcakes, and it did make money, but not huge sums of money, because it was never written as a textbook even, although it was used at the graduate level as a book by many people. Although I give a course in coordination chemistry, and I've never really required it that it be used, although I put it on reserve in the library and tell people that the book exists, and some of them take advantage of having a look at it.
You mentioned that it was easy the first time because most of the work was being done by you and Taube and others. Was there any work going on outside of Europe? I mean, in Europe, or mostly in this country?
Mostly in the U.S., I think. In fact, I have a story that I always tell when I give this talk on carbon monoxide substitution in metal carbonyls and substituted metal carbonyls, how we got into that. When I was in Copenhagen, 54-55, in May, Mary and I, my wife, left the two kids with the babysitter and people in the neighborhood there that we'd gotten to know by then. And we took off. We'd never been to Europe on the continent before. And so the first stop was in Amsterdam, one of the first stops, where I attended an international conference on coordination chemistry. And one of the plenary lectures was given by the late Walter Heber. Walter Heber did not discover metal carbonyls, but he's really known as the father of metal carbonyl chemistry, because Mond, who did discover metal carbonyls, was in industry, and he never published too much about it. You know, he didn't continue the work. He certainly did discover it and did patent, I guess, the discovery and whatever. But Walter Heber had an institute at the Technical University of Munich, with never less than 40 or 50 people working, and they were all working on metal carbonyl chemistry, synthesis reactions, and so forth for umpteen years. He was a bachelor. He was just wed to metal carbonyl chemistry. So in this plenary lecture, he had slide after slide after slide that he showed the work that they had done. And when it was all over with, he had given this in German because he couldn't handle English, didn't know English. But you could tell from the slides that he had what was done. And when it was all over with, I complimented him in English. Of course, I don't know any German. And said, gee, this is all very nice. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of these reactions take place? And through an interpreter, he looked at me. He said, young man, you know, 55, I was a lot younger. He said, young man, in my institute, we do real chemistry. We don't do the philosophy of chemistry. So, what he really said was, we're interested in reactions and synthesis, and we don't give a damn about theories of bonding or this, that, or the other, and mechanisms. Shall we take a men's little moment?
All right. Let's go back for a moment to your sabbatical in Denmark, because you did publish two papers out of that. You'd already told me about how much absorption spectra is being measured there.
That's right.
Did you introduce in the mechanisms when you were there?
Well, yes, yes. In fact, one of the papers that I published there was with Arthur Adamson.
That was my next...
And Adamson and his family happened to be there just at the same time, unbeknown to me. And Dave Hume, who is an analytical chemist at MIT, and his family happened to. So the three of us showed up with Yannick Bier that same year for a year's leave of absence. And it was kind of nice, particularly for the wives, the spouses and families, that they got together and so forth and could keep in touch. But Arthur and I... Dave did some writing. He didn't do any experimental work. But Arthur and I were in this same laboratory. That is a laboratory that was used even by S.M. Jorgensen, who was really the pioneer of making these metal complexes.
Oh, he's in the dedication of your book.
In the dedication of the book. I have samples, if you're interested in seeing them, that are a century old. Arthur was interested, as a physical chemist that he is, in particularly electron transfer type reactions that Henry Cobbe was doing and so forth. But he also pitched in and did a piece of work with me in connection with this conjugate base mechanism. One thing that you needed to know was that the hydrogen-deuterium exchange
radium technique to get the hydrogen deuterium content. And we asked whether we could use, we could come and use his setup. And he said, oh, yes, you just tell me, give me a couple of days. And so we got our compounds and solutions ready to go, and we went over.
And when we got there, he had his white lab coat on, with his assistant with her white lab coat on, and they wouldn't let us touch the apparatus. They said, oh, no, it's too much trouble. We'd have to teach you how to do it, this, that, and that. You give us the solutions and so forth, and we'll actually do experiment. So here was the director of this fancy lab, internationally known guy in bioinorganic physical chemistry, Lindstrom Long, who was that day at least being our assistant, and he was making the measurements. And he was also a delightful person who had numerous stories to tell, so he was telling jokes all day, had a terrific sense of humor. So Arthur and I did publish jointly that paper, which was a definitive paper. It was needed. Somebody had to do that experiment, and we did it.
How did you decide on going there?
Well, as a coordination chemist, I wanted to go someplace, and at that time, it had become known that that people were measuring stability constants, stepwise stability constants of metal complexes, and that this was a fashionable thing to do in this country. Fernelius, for example, at Penn State at that time, had a group of people that deal with a bunch of pH meters measuring all these things and so forth. And the person, and I knew from reading the literature, that the person that had really done the seminal work on this was Yannick Biehm. And I just decided that, well, here's a coordination chemist who has done something that seems to be very timely and significant. And correspondence with him, I arranged to go there. I had no other reason. And it turned out to be a very delightful year, because even before we went, I guess the announcement that I'd got my Guggenheim Fellowship or something showed up in the campus paper or someplace. And one of the graduate students came around and said, look, my girlfriend lives in Copenhagen, and if you need any help with housing or something, I can write to her. And he did. She put an ad in the Politiken, the local paper, you know. And not long afterwards, we had arranged to move into this house, a nice small house, a nice residential area built right after the war, with people our age, with children. Our two children were 6 and 4 at the time, of the same age. And they were, one was a crystallographer and one was a physicist, I think, at the university. And they were going to be on leave for a year. I guess one was at MIT and one was at Harvard. And they were delighted to have us show up just at the time that they left. So they left all the linens and all the dishes and everything in their house. And the neighbors were just waiting for us with open arms, because they all knew enough English and they wanted to
it was, I guess, shortly after that. You talked earlier about this group of graduate students that you had who were so productive. And I wonder whether we could talk a little more about some of them. Harry Gray, of course, being, as you said, I think the word you used was the most notorious.
Well, that's the way it's turned out, I think. he's certainly done exceedingly well, and he's been very kind to Northwestern and to me and Ralph, of course. Yeah.
What was he like as a graduate student?
I think he was no different as a graduate student. He arrived here from Western Kentucky, And, you know, he wasn't as polished as he is now and wasn't as mature by any means. We used to tease him about not even having any shoes and all, and coming here in his bare feet and so forth. But he was a very dynamic graduate student. He got involved not only in his own research, but through talking to other graduate students, he would sometimes get involved in some things that they were doing as well. Not necessarily just in my group and Christian's groups. But, for example, Carol King, an organic chemist, was making some sulfur compounds, and the guy that was doing this was a friend of Harry's, I guess, and Harry said, "Well, yeah, we ought to make some metal complexes of those sulfur, look at that." And they made metal complexes, and they published a paper, you know, and so forth. I guess King's name was on it, but certainly our names were not. And so Harry was that kind of a guy. He was a real winner. He didn't like to lose. He liked to keep things moving ahead. And in fact, it was interesting because it was just at the time that Joe Chatt, who was an outstanding organometallic chemist, should have shared the Nobel Prize with Fisher and Wilkinson, in my opinion anyway, had a person by the name of Bernard Shaw, who's done real well at Leeds, as a graduate student. I had Harry Gray here as a graduate student, and Chatt was making these platinum organometallic type compounds, and Harry Gray was measuring kinetics and substitution reactions by conductivity methods and so forth. And Chatt and I, at one of these international conferences on coordination chemistry, got together on this. And I said, "Well, if you send us the compounds, we'll do the experiments." And he said, "Okay." When he got back, he got Bernard Shaw to bottle up some of these samples and he'd send them, and Harry would do the experiments, and we'd send the results back and ask for more compounds. And I didn't realize that this was happening, and I'm sure it's just a Chatt's way of making a good story. And one of these things where he contributed to the 100th volume of Journal of Organometallic Chemistry or something, a general article, a fun kind of summary paper. He pointed out that Bernard Shaw, who was making, that he and I had this good arrangement going, because Shaw couldn't make the compounds fast enough, from saying, "Oh, how fast these guys are doing the kinetics," and Harry Gray was saying, "Gee, I can't keep up with this guy Shaw, who's making these compounds so fast." So Chatt was explaining this as how we conned them into thinking that they had to work harder, you know, to make more compounds, or work faster to get more kinetics done because the compounds are coming. And as a result, we got this big long paper on the trans effect and everything else. But Angelisi was very good, and he was not Harry Gray. There's only one Harry Gray, and Andy Wojcicki was outstanding, and so forth. It was just at a time when an awful lot of very good people showed up here wanting to do graduate work in inorganic chemistry, and that's understandable, because if you think back even at that time, there weren't all that many departments that had exciting things going research-wise in inorganic chemistry. Inorganic chemistry in most departments, even some of the very better departments, was just teaching general chemistry, more or less. And so after you thought of half a dozen or fewer even, that was it. And we happened to be among those, in fact, probably at that point, with the work that Ralph and I was doing, the book and everything else, we were not only among them, we were probably right at the top of all of them. So we really did have access to good graduate students in inorganic chemistry. We still do. the whole precedence that was established then in inorganic still pertains, and we still have access. But now, of course, there's lots of good inorganic chemistry going on in a lot of different places, so we're competing with a lot more places. But that wasn't true then. And it was also true that these people that came at that time, if they were interested in an academic position, they had multiple offers of very good places, because in those days, when the universities were expanding and they had an addition, they had an opportunity to add an additional spot, they would look at their existing faculty. They had quite a few organic chemists, also quite a few physical, maybe analytical or two thrown in. But a lot of places didn't have a single inorganic chemist, so they were all really writing to us like mad, wanting to hire inorganic chemists. And fortunately, we had some, and we had some good ones, and they turned out to go out and do well for themselves, and as a result, also reflect well on the department, naturally.
Of course, what's happened, isn't it, that you created your own competition.
Well, that's right. That's what's happened now. But we managed to keep up. I'm pleased to say that the department and the university here has had enough foresight to allow the inorganic group here on different occasions to really make a strong enough pitch for the fact that we've got a good, strong team, and let's keep it competitive. And I think even now, we are certainly having to compete with a lot more places, but our department is still ranked among the better departments. For example, in 69-70, when I was asked to do my tour of duty as a chairman, at that time it was a 5-year chairmanship rotating, and I said, oh God, I can't do it for 5 years. I may not enjoy it, I may not do it well. Let's do it for 3. Well, they reluctantly agreed. I said, let's do it for 3, and if I do well and you people want me, you can try to, maybe we can do it for 3 more. That'll be 6 instead of 5. And so we went along on that. And then the other demand that I had before I took it was, look, we still get a lot of inorganic chemists. This was in 69. And if I'm going to be full-time chairman, really, I'm not going to have all that much time to take on additional students and take good care of them. So we really have to have a young inorganic chemist as an additional spot. Well, the department, of course, agreed. They didn't hesitate. But then it was a time when you had to convince the College of Arts and Sciences University that they should add an additional spot, because they were, in some cases, not even taking care of attrition, you know, and so forth. So, but they finally did. I said, well, it's either that or I don't take on the chairmanship, because we do get inorganic chemists, and I feel obligated to make sure that that's covered before I do anything else. So it turned out that that spot came along rather late in the day, and I made a bunch of phone calls, and one of the guys I called was F. Albert Cotton. He was still at MIT. And he said, oh God, we got just the guy. He's done so much already. He could leave tomorrow and so forth, but he doesn't want to get his degree right away because of the Vietnam War. As soon as you get your degree, you're susceptible. And if you guys are flexible and can hang in there for a while, it would work out. But it turned out to be Tobin Marks. Tobin Marks is just a world beater, you know. He's here now and has done such a fabulous thing, amount of inorganic chemistry and so forth. So we went out and we got Ibers and we went for Brookhaven and we got Tobin Marks, and of course we had Schreiber, and we've always been able to add people and add good people and maintain our strength. If anything, our strength is even improved. It's improved, but it's improved along with the others having improved, so it's certainly more competitive now.
Coming back to that group again, you mentioned that Harry Gray came from Western Kentucky. Did the others come from small college undergraduate backgrounds?
Yeah. Andy Wachey came from Brown University, which wasn't a small school, I guess. Angelisi came from St. Olaf. Burmeister came from F&M, and so forth. We get, as is true of all places, we get an awful lot of our people from good liberal arts colleges. As you well know, they do a damn sight better job of undergraduate teaching than we do at the universities, and they really get people motivated in the direction of chemistry and take, again, a personal, professional interest in making sure that these people who are qualified and interested and want to go on do have an opportunity to go. And so that's where these people were from. It's always a bit of a mixture, but by and large, it's from liberal arts colleges. We have so many of them also here in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah. How does your, jumping way ahead here, but how does your undergraduate major population compare to your graduate student population? It's a number of large universities don't produce that many undergraduate majors.
We're no different than any place else. No, I think that we are suffering much like every place else. In fact, at the moment, it's almost a little embarrassing, you know, that you start out, as I tell my colleagues, they don't like to hear me say this, but it is absolutely true. It's even more so at big state schools, but at our place, we start out with about 800 or so freshmen taking either honors course or whatever, taking beginning chemistry. We're lucky to end up with 4 or 5, it's a good year if we have 6 chem majors going on to do graduate work in chemistry. And we could end up with 2 or 3 only. And as I point out to them, God damn it, if you start out with 800, and if you even just intentionally try to turn people off, turn them away from chemistry, you couldn't be more efficient and effective than we are. And here we are telling ourselves that we're just trying to do the opposite. We're trying to get them all fired up and going into chemistry. So I don't know, we must all be doing something wrong. I mean, this is not just Northwestern, I think it's across the country in the universities. I think liberal arts colleges are still doing what needs to be done and doing it well.
Well, you made the comment earlier in your own experience that you certainly had the attention of the four horsemen.
That's right.
Who cared about you, I'm sure, a lot more than anyone here could begin to
worry
about. And that's where the motivation comes from, as you said. I had the same experience.
Absolutely. You know, graduate programs in science and engineering at the moment, if it weren't for foreign students, would be really scraping the bottom of the barrel. I mean, in our department, we still have an awful lot of non-foreign students, but we do have several Asians and several foreign students. But if you look in all of tech, this is the engineering building, number of foreign students is beginning to exceed 50% in some of these departments, and even some of the faculty, several of the faculty are beginning to be foreign rather than Americans, and I don't know, I mean, you know, it's talked about a lot, and there are all sorts of things that are said, but it really hasn't been possible to turn this around at the moment. It's pretty bad shape.
Well, with a little bit, I do want to get to your term with ACS and a lot of things that happened in those years, too, because you had some very strong views on certain subjects, and I want to talk about that.
Sure, okay.
Let's sort of move ahead a little bit through my notes. continued on the Carbon Hills for a long time, a number of people, but then you also made an Italian connection somewhere along the line. And how did that come about?
Well, that came about because my name ends in O, I guess, for one reason. And I've always felt, that connection. As I say, I learned how to speak this peasant dialect of Italian before I learned how to speak English, even. And lived in this little mining community where you could go day in and day out, and all the people there were foreigners, and many of them were Italians. Anyway, in terms of chemistry, there were two or three Italians that were publishing in coordination chemistry, the kind of chemistry that I was doing. And one in particular, Professor Sacconi, Luigi Sacconi, he was not professor at the time, and his first professorship was actually at Palermo. I can tell you a lot of stories about Sacconi, but I won't bore you with the details. But in any case, his English wasn't all that good. And so on this one occasion in 55, when Mary and I drove around Europe, we went to Italy. I still have second and third cousins, and so forth. We visited the cousins in northern Italy, and my Italian was perfect. I could speak Piemontese with them, and they understood me, and I understood them. But then we took off, and we went to the universities. In Milan, Malatesta was an outstanding, Yannick chemist, Croato at Padua, and Sacconi at Florence, and Cagliotti at Rome. So we purposely went to these places as tourists, and they didn't know I was coming. And when we got there, I'd get on the phone and call them up, and if they were in town, they would immediately drop everything and come and look after me. And the one thing that Sacconi really wanted to warm up in 55 to me for was that he was beginning to want to publish his papers in English journals, the Journal of Chemical Society, Royal Society of London, or Journal of American Chemical Society. He was fed up with the Gazzetta, the Italian thing that nobody would read. He said, I do all this good work and I put it in the Gazzetta, nobody reads it. So he wanted to publish in English. And he conned me into helping him write these papers in English. And so he would send me a manuscript and I would edit it, not change the chemistry, but change the words and put it in better English. And then he would submit these, and he got an awful lot of visibility because he started publishing his papers in English, in the English journals. And so that was really the thing that established an Italian connection, because he was very influential. But then the big power in inorganic chemistry back in the 60s was Vincenzo Cagliotti, who was really capo della mafia of inorganic chemistry in Rome. And even Sacconi and Malatesta and all these other guys would come there, and he would dole out whatever monies that the Italian NSF equivalent, Congresso Nazionale di Research has to them, and they would decide on who should be promoted to professorships and so forth. But Cagliotti was a man. And on this one occasion that Sacconi had set up a lecture tour throughout Italy for me, Sacconi felt like it should, Cagliotti felt like it probably should not have been Sacconi that had done this, it should have been Cagliotti that had done this. But in any case, Cagliotti got me off to the side. Cagliotti didn't speak any English, but my Italian was good enough so we could communicate. And he said, now the next time you go on leave and so forth, I want you to come here and this, that, and the other. And made it such a nice offer that we did go there in 61, 62. By that time, we had two additional children, so my four, and my wife and myself. And that's when we lived in the suburb. He had arranged for us to stay in this big villa, you know, in Monte Sacro outside of Rome. But there are no English-speaking people there, even in the shops. So Mary and the kids had a little bit of a rough time. I used to be. Used to enjoy it because my Italian's good enough that I could at least communicate. People recognize right away I'm not Italian, but we could communicate. But then Coyote, because of our being there all year and because of my knowing a lot of coordination chemists who he had invited to come, especially because I was there during the year, and everything, why he saw to it that I got into the Lincea, the Academy of Sciences, which is the oldest academy of science in existence, founded by Galileo. And likewise, in Turin, where Turin is the northern part of Italy, where they were doing some carbonyl work at the same time we were, and they knew about our work, and I visited them, and we exchanged ideas and so forth. A few years ago, they gave me an honorary degree and so forth. And so they've been more than kind. And I have always invitations to go to Italy, and I never turn them down.
Italians, some of the early people to do photochemistry.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You never got, you have one paper.
Yeah, a little bit, but not all that much. Everything's taken care of on that.
Yeah,
I sent the facts.
You give that letter.
Okay.
I want to give you one more.
Sure, give it to me. We'll take care of this also. I don't know what happened.
Thank you very much.
I don't know what happened with the other one, but we'll take
care of it. Probably the mismanager or somehow.
Well, whatever. Yeah. You never know. But anyway, we'll take care of it. Okay. Yes, Cimo Chan, whatever the guy's name was in Milan, did organophotochemistry. Well, some inorganic as well, some cyanide complexes, I guess. But mostly organophotochemistry by putting things out in the sunlight.
Yes. But then later on, when the big move into the photochemistry of inorganic materials began,
I never got involved, really.
Yeah.
That's right.
I was going to ask you why. You have a little bit, but not.
I don't know. Arthur Adamson really was the guy that did that. Carosetti in Italy was the guy that started it there. In our case, I think by that time, we were well into the metal carbonyl stuff, and we were just doing the thermal substitutions, although these things are known to photochemically active and very high quantum yields and so forth. But we didn't get involved with the photochemistry, and there was no real reason that I know why we didn't. Things were going so well without getting involved with the photochemistry, so we didn't bother. And that was being taken care of very nicely by other people, Harry Gray and Mark Wrighton, of course, and some people in Mark Wrighton at Penn State wrote a book on photochemistry of organometallic. The little bit that we did was because we stumbled on some chemistry that came along as a result of the discovery of dinitrogen as a ligand. That was discovered in the mid-60s, I believe, by Allen and Senoff with the ruthenium compound. And if you think of dinitrogen, it is isoelectronic with carbon monoxide. So even when Andy Wojcicki was here and we were doing metal carbonyl chemistry, we put some dinitrogen and dicobolactocarbonyl in one of Hermann Pines' bombs, you know, and revved up the pressure of dinitrogen, hoping to make a dinitrogen compound, because to us, you know, I'm pretty pedestrian in my theory. I just count electrons, and if it's isoelectronic, it ought to have some tendency maybe to react, but it didn't. And then later, when it was discovered under certain these circumstances that it did behave as a ligand, then everybody jumped on the bandwagon. Taube, us, everybody else, wanting to really exploit this as much as possible, and particularly the biome inorganic chemists wanting to understand nitrogenase and how it works, you know, and the inorganic chemists hopefully wanting to activate the nitrogen-nitrogen bond to, I don't know whether they're going to compete with the Haber process or what, but anyway, do something. And we and we d- we decided we knew how to make some of these using the Zitto compound, feridium, I guess, initially, and then rhodium and so forth. And in the process of doing this, which we got to work nicely, and we think it goes through a nitrene intermediate, it was noticed that these compounds, these even in the solid state, the white crystals would take on a gray appearance, and clearly we immediately began to suspect that they were photochemically active, because the Zitto groups can be photolyzed to give off dinitrogen and so forth. So that's how we ended up doing a little bit of photochemistry, just as it pertained to those that system, which we didn't continue beyond just publishing a few papers.
Was there anyone here doing photochemistry at the time?
I think Letzinger had done some photochemistry with some organic compounds. Fred Lewis had arrived on the scene I guess he might have been assistant or associate professor at the time that we were doing it. So we did have some people to turn to. But more than that, I was fortunate in Arthur Adamson sending me a postdoc, a guy by the name of Gaffney, who's now at New York University, I think, and the City University, and Harry was the guy that was able to do this and do it properly and take care of the one graduate student that I had who was working on it. So he was very helpful.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed, and I commented to Dr. Hurd yesterday the same thing, is that his work was very varied, but he had a number of different collaborators. And in some respects, you've done the same thing, because you had a paper going way back with Gordon Barrow, and he attributed some of that to just the interaction of the faculty within the Northwestern department.
Clearly that's true, and you may see some of it as we have lunch today, because that's been going on. It just grew, you know. It was not done by intent. It just happened really when we all arrived at the same time and started eating lunch together and so forth. But as a result of that, Pearson and I started right from the beginning, you know, collaborating and having joint students and joint projects and applying for joint grants. You know, our names would be on it as joint PIs and so forth. And that kind of environment, which grew within the department, has now extended outside of the department, and it's very prevalent. So there's a lot of interdisciplinary stuff going on now. I mean, we have this catalysis group, which Wolfgang Sockler is the Hypatia professor now, and they managed to get him a new kind of building just adjacent to this annex. Building a nice laboratory, but in that laboratory he has not only chemists, he himself is a chemist, but he has chemical engineers, he has material scientists, he has even physicists or two thrown in, I think. So it's a very interdisciplinary thing, and a lot of the work that's going on now, people doing solid state work where they're ending up wanting to examine electrical properties, there's collaborative work with people in electrical engineering and so forth, so that that is something that's kind of unique at Northwestern, and was going on even in the days of Charles Hurd, and certainly in the days when we were getting started and so forth. And I think it's just because the size of the department is small. It's not like a big state school where
that inorganic chemistry is autonomous from organic, from anything else. From the very beginning, we were small enough that we could kind of interact, and we do interact as a department. We have departmental meetings. The chairman is the chairman, not a head. And we decide policy on the basis of democratic approach. I mean, you have your yays and nays, and if the yays are exceed the nays, that's the way it is. And a beginning assistant professor who has just arrived on the scene and doesn't even know where the men's room is, at such a meeting, his vote counts exactly the same as my vote, which I've been here 40 years, for example. And that's fine. That's perfectly all right. We do, of course, have tenure people meeting separate from non-tenure people, naturally. But so the department has always had that kind of thing, and I think it began when a lot of beginning instructors were brought in at the same time, and they began to interact with one another.
You were away from the carbonyl work for a long time, but you got back to it.
Yeah, that's right. And that happened. You know, funding is so much research now is driven by funding. When I first arrived here, there was no place to go for funding, so you didn't have to worry about it. But that's no longer the case. And in fact, I was just writing this morning, just beginning to write this summary thing. We were getting NIH support. I was getting NIH support because of the fact that we were doing solution chemistry of metal complexes. So I would write a research proposal, indicate what we were doing in terms of our studies, and then, in one or two sentences only, I would indicate that, gee, this fundamental understanding of these kinds of principles and all of this just has to be of importance to people who are looking at biological systems, whether they be metalloenzymes or metalloproteins and so forth. And that was enough. And NIH would support it. Not only would they support it for 15 or 20 years. I was even on a panel, an NIH panel years ago, and Toby and I happened to be on at the same time. Just at the time that Senator Manson proposed a bill in Congress that the federal agencies, other than NSF, well, even NSF, I guess, but the federal agencies should not fund research unless it was closely and directly related to their mission. So it was clear to me, writing was on the wall, that the next time around, chances of getting money from NIH were going to certainly diminish because this was not that close. What they really wanted was some, because their mission is health, they wanted something that would cure a disease, or at least would be related to some health, much closer to health related. Well, I'd always had in mind anyway something that was of interest to me, but just never gotten around to suggesting it to anybody or getting anything started on it, and that was synthetic oxygen carriers. Because Melvin Calvin, you know, years ago did a lot of this kind of work, but his work was solid state gas phase type interaction, and that was supported during World War II because the Office of Naval Research had money for this purpose of fixing dioxygen. Submarine warfare, you know, you can come to the surface, collect oxygen. When the enemy comes, you can go down and release the oxygen and so forth. And there, it's been known for a long time that there are certain kinds of cobalt-2 chelates that are capable of doing this. And so Calvin published a lot of papers on these cobalt complexes that do this. Well, I decided, gee, let's do some solution chemistry. It won't be all that different. It'll still have to do with kinetics and mechanisms of oxygen uptake and oxygen release and this, that, and the other. So my first student, Al Crummis, who's now a professor of chemistry at Duke University, came by And that was what he and I decided to do. The reason I wanted to do that, of course, is to do some preliminary work so that then I could write a proposal to NIH and say, look, this is now quite closely related to things of interest to the Institute of Heart and Lung. You know, a lot of the old codgers on the hill are dying of heart attacks and this and lung cancer and everything else. And so I was pretty sure that this would probably have a much better chance of flying than just the other stuff. And sure enough, it did fly, so then they supported it. And by that time, we had added two or three other inorganic faculty, and so I decided to devote all my time to just the synthetic oxygen work and stop the middle carbonyl work. And then I became president of the ACS, and it was time to write a renewal proposal for the oxygen work, and I did it. But I could have done it better had I really taking the time to do my homework properly. So I got a priority rating that was not fundable, that it was high enough that they wanted me to resubmit. They encouraged me to resubmit, but I decided the hell with it. I'm getting far enough along that I'm not going to even bother to fight my way to that extent, and I stuck with just doing carbonyl substitution. And by that time, there were several people around here. Bill Trobler was across the hall as an assistant professor, and he and I used to talk about things of mutual interest. The inorganic group here has a very interesting, unique thing. Every Saturday morning, we get together informally and have a chalk talk kind of research conference, not a seminar. We do have a seminar, but that's not it. Something Pearson and I started many years ago. And on these Saturday mornings when I'm in town, I'm always there, and I'm always, the name of the game is to, which is good for the students and postdocs, is they have to be able to present what they want without slides or transparencies, and they have to be able to respond to questions and comments, on their feet. And so a lot of interruptions, and I ask a lot of questions and a lot of suggestions. In fact, I have a little plaque that was given to me at Basolo 70, which comes as a result of this. This guy now is professor at Colorado State University. He was a student, not of mine. He was a student of Shriver's, but he was doing some work, and he was suggesting that such and such was going to happen. And I said, oh, no. And that's not the way it'll be. I'll bet you a quarter. My limit is always a quarter. And over the years, I've lost a few quarters, but by and large, I won most of them. And the reason is, these guys don't realize what they're doing, and they're usually specific about what's going to happen. And usually, my bet is that isn't what's going to happen. And I don't limit myself to the fact that this is what's going to happen, but something else other than that's going to happen. Usually I have in mind what's going to happen, but my chance of winning is much better than theirs, because in order for them to win, they would have to have specifically that one thing that they say is going to happen. So anyway, kids know that the solo is going to ask a lot of questions on Saturday morning at these things.
Well, I remember that I found that to be the most valuable experience I had as a graduate student.
Giving seminars and
having, sure. Knowing you had to be responsible for what you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And prepared.
I think our students really are very well prepared when they leave here, whether it be industry or what, because if we don't try to embarrass them, we try to, we just try to engage them in conversation and challenge them a little bit and so forth.
Yes, at Valparaiso, we had to start giving seminars in our junior year as an undergraduate. We had four full semesters. When I got to graduate school, giving a seminar in front of my colleagues was an old experience.
Old hat, sure.
Whereas
sure.
Some of my peers had never given one in their life. And,
it makes a difference, absolutely, yeah.
Well, why don't we move into your reluctant candidacy as president of the ACS.
Okay.
I guess I could use that term correctly.
Well, whatever.
I mean, it was not something that you sought out specifically.
Is that well, that's true. I had never been really active at the national level in the American Chemical Society, or even at the local level. But I had been, I guess, chairman of the inorganic division of the American Chemical Society, so that is at the national level. And I'd always expressed my views when I had views, and I always have some views. And they're usually not mainstream views. And so on this one occasion, there were two candidates that had been nominated for president-elect. And there were some people out there that didn't want either one of them to win for whatever the reason. And I had a couple, two or three phone calls from people that I had a lot of respect for, saying, look, if you're serious about some of the comments I've heard you made, or if you really want to be of help, why don't you let us petition you for president-elect? I said, oh my God, I don't know that I want to get involved to that extent. It's a lot easier to stand on the sideline, you know, and make comments than it is to grab the ball and start running with it. But I said, look, let me think about it over the weekend, and you can get back to me. And eventually they talked me into it, and I said, look, I'm not going to raise a finger to get myself elected, but if you guys think it's possible and want to go ahead and so forth, I'll go ahead. And they did, and I did get elected without the second election or anything else. So I came on the scene really as a novice in terms of understanding the bureaucracy in the ACS, the staff bureaucracy, and understanding the good old man type attitude, you know, the guys that have been working at the national level for, well, it's their professional life, really. I mean, some of them spend all their time doing that. They're back home, they do very little. But there, they do a lot, and they do it well. The only one thing that bothered me always was they do it so well that they insist on being reappointed and reappointed and reappointed. And it means that it takes up a spot that other people cannot. One thing that they won't do is step aside and let somebody else. And I've never known any organization where you can perpetuate yourself for forever. Except the ACS. I mean, other appointments that you have are term appointments. They might be 5 years with a renewal for five, but then it's understood that after that, that's it. And this was one of the things that I wanted to do in the ACS. I didn't care how long. I mean, as long as they could decide how long, whether 10 years was the right number of total years or whether 12 or 15. But some kind of total years, because the first thing that you have to do when you become president-elect of the ACS, first thing they ask you to do, is to reappoint people on these various committees. And I got immediately into hot water because there were three or four people there that I just wouldn't appoint, because I knew that some people that I thought should really be on such committees, publication or whatever it was. And so I didn't appoint them. And then these people, of course, couldn't understand why they weren't reappointed, because they'd done such a good job for 20, 30 years on first one committee and then another and so forth. But anyway, I was told to go before committee on committees to explain my position on this. And it was unbelievable, like going into a lion's den. You know, these committees are so huge because everybody gets their way paid at the meeting or whatever. And so they make these committees as big as they could possibly finance. And there must have been 20 or 15 or 20 members in this committee on committees. And when I walked in there to explain where I was coming from and why I was saying this,
I could look and I could see all these people, all of them had already been there 20 years. So years, and they knew they'd done a good job and would want to continue. They wouldn't want to stop, and that's the whole point of it. And it was kind of a useless exercise on my part. My idea was we should have a bylaw which would limit the total number of years, and that would then make it easier for the president-elect or whoever is appointing things, because people would understand that after they've served their 10 or 12 years or however much, and if you can't do what you think needs to be done in 10 or 12 years, then you damn well ought to step aside and let somebody else try. Well, that was one thing. The other thing that really blew them out of the water was my insisting that we certainly don't need two national meetings a year. We need only one. And by this time, in 83, it was obvious that scientists, chemists, in this case, are spending so damn much time, symposia, national, international, so forth. There's so many meetings. The big job of someone arranging a program for a meeting is to find a date that doesn't conflict with another meeting. and I, by that time, realized that the ACS, I'd been going to ACS meetings, and I knew that if you go into a general, here a general paper and symposia, the inorganic chemists and others, I think, have done a real good job at symposia. They bring in good symposium speakers, and they're very well attended. Everybody wants to go here, Harry Gray or whoever else is, Roe Hoffman or whoever the hell else. But those 15-minute papers or whatever it is, it was embarrassing. I mean, the guy that was talking and the guy that was about to follow him, and the projectionist, when they still had a projectionist, and so forth, and there was nobody there. So you couldn't justify it on the basis of the science being reported, and you couldn't justify it on the business, because the board of directors and people like that could meet at other times and if they need to, and committees could meet whenever they needed to meet. And one meeting a year is what most chemical societies have. They don't have multiple meetings. ACS now is gradually going towards three meetings a year. We think the Pacific Coast meeting and the Canadian one. So, well, that didn't fly, even though there was this questionnaire that was put out, I guess, with something or other that came out from the ACS, asking people whether they would be willing to try this on an experimental basis. And the response was not very great. But of the response, it was 2-1 that it should be tried. At least we could try it. But when it came down to the board decision, there was only one vote in favor of trying it. That was me. My idea, of course, was we could have one meeting a year and we could be more supportive of the regional meetings, because it's getting so expensive to go to these big national meetings, and at least for the graduate students and postdocs, the regional meetings and the places where it could be much more accommodating, and it seemed to me that more could be done there, the effort of the staff, because the staff was also worried, you know, staff, they got a huge staff, and they spend so much time on these national meetings, and no sooner than one is over, they're already working on another one, this, that, the other. And my point was, well, yeah, I don't think you need to worry about it, because you can spend that time on the regional meetings and being helpful there. But no, everybody wanted to go to. There was other reasons. Another reason is, if you have only one national meeting, and if you're really serious about wanting to meet some people at a meeting, and there's only one, then the chances of meeting that person are far greater than if there are two or even three meetings, because you may go to one, and that person may go to another one. So there were reasons for doing this, but the bureaucracy was such that it didn't even get off the ground. The whole point is, these people are voting with their feet, you know, as long as we have 10, 12,000 or 8,000 even, or whatever number it is, that come to these meetings, then the meeting is necessary. But my idea is, a meeting is not necessary. These people come just because there is a meeting. And it's wasteful of of time and energy and cost of whatever to go to meetings, which are not necessary. We already have far too many meetings. I still feel that way.
Well, I was involved with MARM for a while myself, and there's another whole audience out there of people at small liberal arts colleges, which is, I think, a reasonable segment, who just don't have the wherewithal financially to go to national meetings.
Of course.
And so once every 5 years, if it's in 100 miles away, you might get there for a couple of days.
Well, you ought to break into the national governance of the society and committees and so forth. Once you get into that category and make friends and so forth and get kept on and on and on and on, you can go to all the national meetings.
Well, I do now as a result of my new association. But,
okay.
And that's, you know, that's another thing. I have seen this in local sections where counselors are self-perpetuating for decades.
Absolutely.
Well, that also leads us into another thing that you were rather strong about in print, and that is... mechanism of ACS governance as a whole, and the fact that you thought the number of committees could be substantially reduced and still accomplish the same.
I'm sure that's still true.
These are obviously very strong viewpoints. I was wondering, in addition to the people who were on the side you were looking at, what kind of response did you get from your colleagues on these two areas?
Well, I think that my colleagues, if you're talking about colleagues that I come in contact with other than people who are ACS active, were very supportive. Gee, that's a great idea. That's wonderful. That's my dues. And we don't have to have all those committees. That's wonderful. So I think that, but that's the group that's the silent group that never really expresses themselves or get involved. Sometimes they don't even bother to take time to vote for president-elect and people on the board of directors. Those people were supportive, and those people seemed to be sympathetic with what I was saying. But the minute I started talking to people who were in the governance of the ACS and had been for 20, 30 years, or whatever, they couldn't appreciate at all what I was saying. But it was so obvious to me that there are committees that are absolutely necessary. I mean, you know, the Chemical Abstract Committee, the Public Relations Committee, the Education, you know, there are all sorts of committees that are absolutely necessary, and people are doing a good job. I'm not faulting all that. But there are committees that are set up, and they're maybe they were necessary when they were set up, but they don't go away. And they're struggling to keep themselves busy and to justify their existence, some of them. And that's ridiculous. I mean, and not only are there too many committees, but all these committees have a tendency to then set up task forces, you know, this, that, and the other. So they compound one another and so forth and so on. I'm sure you can get rid of half of those committees and task force and so forth, and the ACS would be properly governed. The governance and everything else would be as run smoothly as it does.
Have you seen much of a change, or any change in the last 7 years?
When I was finished after my third year as because you're president-elect president, and on the board of directors during those 2 years, and then you have one more year as a member of board of directors. At the end of that third year,
I asked to be taken off of all the committees that I was on because I wanted to at least, if I'd gone around talking the way I did and wanting to make room for other people to get on, I wanted to at least do the right thing, and I did. And I haven't really darkened their door since then. I haven't even gone to very many national meetings since then. I should really go to this one because Harry Gray's getting the Priestley Award, and I just feel badly, but I have another commitment, which I'll be in Mexico for 2 weeks, and this was arranged before I even paid attention to when this national meeting is. There's so damn many meetings, you know, but I've got to be at this Congress in Inorganic Chemistry. I'm giving the opening plenary lecture in Mexico City, and then the people wanted me to, because I'd never been to Mexico before, and they wanted me to visit and give a lecture tour at various universities. And so they've got it all set up, and it conflicts with the national meeting, so I'm not going to even be able to go this time that I really wanted to go. So I haven't really been to very many of them. I don't know what's going on in terms of the governance and like.
What would you say? Well, there was another area that you were also vocal about, and that was the academic-industrial interface.
Yes, I've always felt strongly, and my colleagues here can tell you as well, that we ought to, we should have a closer interface, and we should get the two to work together much more so, and make a real effort in that direction. But it's always, it's been a very difficult thing. When I became chairman here, one of the first things I tried, this was 69-70, academic year 69-70, Henry Tobby and I had been on the NIH panel together, and we'd go out to dinner after one of our sessions, say, for example, and he was very enthusiastic about their industrial affiliates. And one reason was, of course, that it was a nice, lucrative thing for the department because the industries, in order to be members, would pay so much a year. But more than that, according to him, it brought into the department an educational aspect that was not there before. It would bring people from industry there, you know, who would give talks and so forth, and so that this was the kind of thing that students just never had access to before, and he thought this was very good. And so it just strengthened my feeling that when I became chairman, I did everything I could to try to get something like that started. Of course, this was an ongoing thing and had been at MIT and had been at Caltech for years and still is. But that was during the Vietnam situation, students protesting, and it was kind of a recession period and so forth. And it never got off the ground. I still blame my colleagues for not being supportive. Their argument was, gee, we try it now, Fred, and we fail at make it more difficult later. But I think if we had tried, we would have been ahead of the pack, and we probably would be better off. We do have one now, but everybody else has one now. It doesn't mean much. What I did salvage from that was the Charles D. Heard lectures. Did he give you a pamphlet on his lecture?
Yes, that was part of the information he gave me here.
Yeah, that came out of my trying to do something so that I almost unilaterally insisted that at least we ought to bring somebody here for 3 days. And we've been very successful. That's been very good. And Charles was a logical guy. He was a senior person. He had a lot of consulting experience with industry and so forth. So I was able to salvage it to that extent. In the ACS, I guess I was a little concerned at one point and disappointed that this happened. You know, the National Research Council, or what is it called? It's a Council for Chemical Research.
Yes, CCR. CCR,
Council for Chemical Research. When they started that, I read all the things that they put out, and universities and so forth should become members, and you get so much money for each PhD, and chemical engineers would get getting a little bit more, but they're getting so much money. And it just didn't make any sense to me, because it seemed to me that these industries that would or then were going to be asked to join and give the money, which would then be passed on, they would prefer to deal directly with the departments that they themselves would like to be supported of. They wouldn't like to put their money in a pot and let somebody else decide what to do with it and everything else. So I felt a little bad. I was a little negative about that, even though that had to do with industry, and I might have said something to that effect, but I don't know how successful that's been. I guess it has not. It's still in existence,
yeah,
I know. And I think that and our department is still a member. I think, you know, you almost cannot be a member of that. You almost have to be in self-defense. But it does bring industry and academic people together, and to that extent, I think it's worthwhile. And the other thing I worried about is that it would set up another bureaucratic bunch of people, staff and otherwise, and consume a lot more time and energy. And why, you know, if there was something of that sort that could be done, why couldn't it be done through PRF or something in the ACS? But anyway.
What would you say that during that time that you were at the top office of ACS was your greatest achievement and your greatest frustration?
Well, you've already heard my greatest frustrations. What I thought was worthwhile, whether it was or not, because you can never really assess these things, was on those occasions when I was called upon to represent the chemist, American Chemical Society, whether it be on the Hill in Washington or in front of a TV tube or something. I thought that gave me an opportunity to try to make the point that chemistry is doing and has done and will continue to do a great deal for mankind. And I know we are all saying that to ourselves. We're all of us are convinced that that's true. We know it's true, but we're always like preaching to the choir, you know, what the hell, it's pointless. But at least this gave me a chance, not just to preach to the choir. I remember the very first time this happened. It was, I think in 83, was the 250th anniversary of Priestley's birth or something like that, and it must have been in February or something, because I'd just become president of the ACS, and so I had to go to his Cumberland home, you know, in Pennsylvania. And the postmaster, they had issued a special stamp.
Oh, yes.
And one of the postmaster people was there, and somebody from the Unitarian Church was there, because he had been very much involved in that. And it was a beautiful day, and we were looking at the house and everything that's there as a national museum kind of thing. And then those of us who were given about 5 minutes to say something got up on the podium. We were all sitting there. It was obviously pretty soon I was going to have to say something. And what I had decided to say was how Priestley was very important in discovering of oxygen, which turned out to be really the beginning of chemistry as we know it, and so forth. But most of the people out there were not chemists. Chemists didn't bother to come. They were theologians. I mean, they were Unitarians and church people and this, that, and the others. And they must have had about 100 people. I don't know, maybe less, maybe 70 or 80 people. But then anyway, there they were. And before it got to me, I decided, damn it, I'll just tell them that if Priestley were here now, he'd be proud to have been a chemist, because chemistry has done so much. He'd be pleased and as punched to see what chemistry has accomplished over all these years and what it is accomplishing. And I used as a vehicle, you know, energy and agriculture and medicine and so forth, pointed out that you're all of us trust our physicians and or a medical doctor, and if they diagnose the ailment properly and give us the right medication, things improve. But the person that really makes these wonder drugs, whatever they happen to be. Usually are research people in the laboratories, biochemists or what have you, and not the physician who does the diagnosis and prescribes the medicine and so forth. Just those kinds of, just off the cuff kind of thing. After it was over with, we had we had some goodies and a little social hour, and the group was breaking up. And two or three of the older Unitarian fellows came up to me and they said, "Gee, sure glad you're here and were able to say what you did. We're surprised. First of all, we're surprised to see anybody here from American Chemical Society. We knew that Priestley was a chemist, but we thought people who were chemists these days weren't making public appearances." Because according to them, all of chemistry, and that wasn't true in those days, it's still true to a great extent, but in those days, dioxin and PCBs and all those things, you know, it was either toxic, carcinogen, or what have you. And so they were glad that I had come along to represent the American Chemical Society and to make a point of all that chemistry has actually accomplished during all these years. So I think it was that. It was being on the Hill a few times to speak and support of education and science research and all those things. And as I say, you never know how much good it does, but at least you have a feeling. You come away that you're not just talking to other chemists.
Were you involved at all with funding for the center?
Funding for the center. Center.
The Beckman Center.
The Beckman Center. Yes, I was involved, at least, you know, before it was even, at the time that it was just called the ACS, I guess. And in my very first meeting, I think I told you at the beginning, I was not an official anything. I was not on the board of directors. I think it was a board of directors meeting that was being held in November or December, and I became a member of the board and president-elect in January, on January the 1st. So they had asked me to come to this board meeting just as an observer. I didn't have a vote, I didn't have anything, but I was observing. And the board of directors had met one or two things. That's usually about a two-day session, and there are lots of things that are discussed and voted on and so forth. And I sat through all this because I felt this is what I, that's the reason I came, and I wanted to sit through and see what the problems were, what things were being discussed and so forth. Well, finally, at some point, Arnold Thackeray made his presentation, and then there was some discussion about whether the ACS should come through with however much it was, 50,000.
Yeah.
And then it was opened up for comments, and even though I probably shouldn't have made a comment, I did make a comment. And the comment was that, gee, after sitting through this last couple of days of discussions, this is the first thing I really heard that's worth talking about. It sounds like it's something that really needs attention, and it would be a wonderful thing if the ACS could come up with the funding and be supportive of this. And of course they did, and they got the what's the other organization that involves the engineers?
Oh, AICHE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So at least initially, to that extent at least, I was involved, which was no involvement at all other than just making a cup. But I was actually then, I guess, put on the advisory board for a few years, because if you look at some of those original chalks that used to come through, I think my name was there because I was president of the ACS.
There's another area which you were also very vocal about 10 years ago, and that has to do with the teaching of inorganic chemistry and where it should be and what general chemistry should be like and so on. I'd like you to comment on that, but did you continue to teach any general chemistry?
Oh yeah, I insisted on teaching.
Okay.
We're on a quarter system, and the general chemistry is taught for 1 year for the regular group. The honors people only have 2 quarters, but the regular group have 3 quarters. And I have, all the years that I've been here, really, except the first 2 or 3 years, have always insisted on teaching one of those 3 quarters. Even when I was president of the ECS, I managed to do that. And I've enjoyed doing it, and I think that the students, well, student evaluations speak for themselves. Students are very enthusiastic about the course that I teach. I use a lot of lecture demonstrations. I teach, as I say, I teach reactions and syntheses. I use trends in the periodic table. I point out the certain kinds of classifications which allow you to make educated guesses, and I point out to them that if they look at the forest instead of the individual trees, this is a pine forest, that's an oak forest, don't worry about the trees, they'll take care of themselves. You don't have to memorize any reactions, not a one, because any reaction I give you in lecture or on the homework, I'll never ask on an exam, so don't bother. But learn how to learn the classification that I give, and then from that, and use of trends in the periodic table, you should be able to make educated guesses and be right 90% of the time. And if you're right 90% of the time in this class, you get an A, and that's the highest grade you can get anyway. And you know, some of those kids, the better ones, of course, some of them are totally lost, and I don't know that anybody could do much for them. But some of the better ones really do catch on, even more so than some of the graduate student TAs who are helping grade the midterms and everything. The graduate student TAs haven't really come to grips with having to learn some of these things in the same sense, and so there are some times during our grading that it's obvious that students know more than the graders. So anyway, I have been outspoken. I have written articles in Journal of Chemical Education and pointed out that I think that we've gone too far. I think that in general chemistry and teaching, first of all, at one point we were teaching only bonding. You know, people knew all about bonding this and bonding that, and rabbit ears this and orbitals that, and they didn't know whether sulfuric acid was a solid, liquid, or a gas, but they sure as hell knew that the sulfate ion is a tetrahedral type orbital hybrid of this type or the other. And then teaching baby physical chemistry, which is kind of pointless. If you're going to teach physical chemistry, why don't you let the physical chemists teach it later on? But it turns out, of course, that a lot of general chemistry is taught by physical chemists, and they feel more comfortable teaching baby physical chemistry than they feel teaching reactions and things. So yes, I have been rather outspoken, and I do think that part of our problem is, in part at least, the fact that we're not teaching enough reactions and things at that level. For those kind of people, might excite somebody. I mean, you know, you see colors change, you see precipitates form, you hear an explosion now and then, or whatever. If you blow up a hydrogen balloon by itself and then blow it up with a mixture of oxygen and hydrogen, you know, you can wake up the class.
Yes. It's true.
And so forth. So students. Take 3 quarters, and year in and year out, over all these years, my quarter always got the highest top rating, of course, and I think it's partly because of the course content.
Mm-hmm. Use a text?
Yes. You can't follow it very much because the texts aren't approaching this in much the same way, but fortunately now. And I think most of the authors even admit that they read this article that Bob Perry and I wrote. I actually wrote it, and I got Bob Perry to put his name on it, hoping that they'd pay a little more attention. And he agreed with it, so that was fine. And Now I noticed that in revision of some of the texts, and some of the texts are doing a little more of this now than they had in the past. But it's still difficult because people that are teaching these things are people who have not learned that kind of chemistry in that manner, and they really are oftentimes physical chemists who feel much more comfortable with the physical chemistry and principles and solving problems and so forth.
I was intrigued, I think it may be in that article with Perry, the way in which you classify mechanisms as a way of making predictions, not stating the question very well, but for example, when I used to teach some organic chemistry to nursing students, I always point out you have a reactive site molecule. If you know what this does in general, it doesn't make any difference what else is around it, you can make a prediction about it. And
that's a nice thing about organic. That's why it's always been so much easier to teach organic chemistry, because you can make esters. Doesn't matter whether you're making it on a huge molecule or a small one, and so forth.
But weren't you, in essence, trying to relate the teaching of inorganic in a similar fashion? No, you can't classify it as neatly as you can in organic.
Sure, and I did it in a very crude, pedestrian way, in terms of using language that's everyday language. For example, combination. There's a whole pile of reactions that are combination reactions. If you take a metal and you add oxygen to it, you make the metal oxide. And then you can talk about some metals being more reactive than others and so forth. And the noble metals, that they wouldn't react, and that's why you have platinum jewelry and gold jewelry and so forth. And then after you get combination, then you do decomposition, and you explain to them that there's certain kinds of things that will decompose when you heat them. I mean, if it's just an ordinary water hydrate, like barium chloride, octahydrate, and you heat it, probably you just drive off the water and you make anhydrous barium chloride. But then you can also tell them that if it's aluminum trichloride, hexahydrate, and you heat it, you sure as hell don't get anhydrous aluminum trichloride. You get aluminum oxide, and then you can explain to them about size and charge a little bit, you know, at the level at which these people can grasp. And it is a classification that is not very sophisticated, but it is a classification that these kids can understand and use. And the better students end up, as I say to them, by the time we're finished, you ought to be able to write thousands of equations without having memorized a single one of them. And some of them can.
Well, I know in the last years I was teaching, I was amazed at what students could memorize.
Oh,
just incredible what they could memorize.
Well, that's it, but that turns them off, you know, if you have to memorize things.
Sure. But I found many of them didn't really I know it was a product of their earlier training, but they had no concept of studying any other way but by memorizing.
Yeah. But you know, if you give a lot of these inorganic reactions and so forth, and it's just reaction, and it makes no sense, and they can't tie it together in any way, there's nothing more deadly than that. That's the way general chemistry used to be taught.
Exactly.
And that was not the right way to teach it either, of course. But I think you can do a better job than that. Look, we're going to have to go upstairs if we can wind it up. How much more do you want to ask?
Well, I mean, I've skipped over some things, but you have covered your a lot of your scientific work and some of these other publications.
Yeah, you have a lot of information. So
I was trying to go behind the scenes and get some other information.
All right.
Appreciate very much. And say thank you for spending the morning with me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I appreciate your dropping by, and Al Thackeray, I'm glad that he put me on the list, and that we have more people here if you ever need more. Everybody gets older all the time, and I'm not even the oldest, you know. Heard and Pines and so forth. Sure.